The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Welcome, everybody.
Dear friends, we had a chance to talk yesterday in the Library of Congress, so we're not going to lose too much time with formal welcomes today. We had the opportunity to do that yesterday, and we want to get into the substantive part of the program right away. So I welcome all of you back to the school. Those of you who were in the old building can see the difference, how the law school has moved ahead, and you'll have an opportunity also to see how we continue to move ahead. In the fall 2015, we're moving into a new law school campus, 8 acres, on the metro line, more or less a mile from here in the Tenley metro station, the Red Line. So when we celebrate the 60th anniversary of the International Project, it will be possible to come to a law school by the metro. So it's going to, that's how that sounds for an enticement. Well, we're going to start right away. It's my pleasure to see all of you here.
Thank you, Dean Grossman, and thank you all for being here. I also won't welcome you again as I did last night. I'll just start the session, but I wanted to say a few administrative points just to make sure that people know about it. If you are interested in going to the wine tour on Saturday or to the tour of the Law Library of Congress where we were last night, and I'll point out that if you've ever written a book, the Law Library of Congress probably has it. So when you go, you could ask them to see if, you could test them to see if they have it. But if you want to go to either of those things, you need to register separately out on the conference room tables, and there's still space for both of those. Idea behind this morning's panel is to take advantage of some of the faculty that have different areas of international law. But more than that, we also all have something else in common. We've all had the privilege of directing the International Legal Studies program for some period of time. And so it's also a time to reflect a little bit on the program and on the direction of international law. I want to first say that Professor Goldman, who was our first director, I believe, has a horrible excuse for not being here right now, which is that he actually has to teach. And so we still prioritize that, of course. And so he is looking forward to being part of the festivities throughout the next day or two and at the receptions as well. But he couldn't make it this morning. I'm not going to spend a long time introducing the people, but I think most of you know each of us. I'm Professor Hunter. I'm going to speak a little bit later about some trends in my field, international environmental law. Professor Pataday Alai will speak, I suspect, on her area of international trade. Professor Bradlow on international development and financial issues, and of course Dean Grossman on human rights. Now, the dean will be visiting us in several different capacities, just to give you a lay of the land for the morning. After this panel, we're going to have a conversation with Dean Grossman and Professor Mendez on their dual roles in the UN relating to torture. And then at lunch, we're going to have a discussion of the new building that Dean Grossman mentioned and give you a little insight into that. Without any further ado, I'm going to let Professor Alai start. We're going to go in the order that we're sitting. Yeah, alphabetical order.
That's good for me, alphabet. I always am the A, so I get to go. If you don't mind, I'll remain seated so we can do an informal conversation. I actually talked to David about what I should talk about today, since I don't really know what the future of international law is going to be, was to not so much talk about the substance of international trade, but about how I have been teaching it and how things have changed and what my observations about my students over the years. It's such an honor and privilege to see familiar faces from days past. The years have melded together, so sometimes I don't know exactly what years we were together, and I'm shocked and surprised at how many years have gone by since I've seen some of you. So it's really an honor and a privilege to have you all here, and to be here, of course, with Danny, David, and Claudio, who I treasure as colleagues and friends on this day. So here, I want to divide my comments into just two parts, which will be brief. One, talk a little bit about trade law, something I've been teaching every semester here, twice a year, the introductory course, with the exception of when I've been on sabbatical. and last semester for some health reasons. When I started teaching international trade and IBT here at the law school in 1997, the WTO had just very recently come into being. So I was very lucky. I came into trade law at a time that it was much more interesting to teach trade than it would have been any time prior to that. And since then, the WTO has sort of jurisprudence has evolved in many, many, many different directions. I can tell you that trade is, of course, still a very specialized area, but I think that my sort of appeal to students to take the course to understand the general international sort of architecture, economic architecture, and to not only be, you know, concerned with the trade practice, has had some following. We have had some people who have no interest in practicing trade, but in the human rights area. Of course, in the environmental area, I think the connection has become much firmer due to the, I would say, the success of the environmental movement in sort of lobbying and integrating itself into the WTO system, where I think that they do play very much of an active part, at least in the jurisprudence of the appellate body. Most of my LLM students and my JD students when I started did not have much background and did not know much about the WTO. Still, many of them may not know about really the jurisprudence and the details of it, but the knowledge level has changed. The exposure has changed. I find that students, maybe they don't know the right things, but they do know that our global governance structures are under assault, that the WTO does attract attention, even if they don't know what the attention is for. They are familiar with people stretched, you know, dressing up as sea turtles and etc. and running around saying that the WTO has caused problems for the environment. They have been exposed to labor issues and fair trade ideas. It's a very different audience that I have today than I did back in 1997. They question things much more. We have our conversations tend to be much more regarding the role of the WTO as a rulemaking authority, as developing a new global administrative regime, not so much about the traditional vision of, you know, removing barriers to trade, which, you know, philosophically is still its underpinning. But I have been also very surprised. One of the things that you guys remember is that there used to be, and there still is to some extent, still we have a division between our LLM and JD population in the sense that people get sort of identified as that when you're in the classroom. It's still the case, but I find enormous amounts of deference. Much more. The JD students have always felt that the LLM students knew more than they did. They have more experience. They come from a different culture. But now I feel that there's much more of a listening to when my LLM students speak, especially when they speak from a place of sort of perspective. And I find that it has always been the case that there was respect, but it's become much more of a conversation. And much more the students, I think our JD students appreciate where they are here at the law school and how much they can gain from their counterparts who have come to study here for a year and get the LLM degree. I have now, the field, of course, of trade has sort of connected itself so much to human rights, environment, labor, and health law that I do find myself talking about those areas and getting questions from the faculty who teach in those areas, which like yesterday I had a conversation with Diane Ortlicker about some WTO issues, and David and I talk a lot, and we've got colleagues here in the health law area, so that has been under the increase, and it will continue to be. In fact, a business law colleague of mine was surprised a few years back when a health law colleague and I were actually, she was saying how important the WTO course is for her area where she teaches. Public international law, of course, has become a big part of WTO jurisprudence. It didn't used to be in 1997 because the GATT tried to be very textual and tried to be very narrow in its analysis of the text of their commitments. Now, under the WTO rules, everything has to be interpreted pursuant to principles of public international law through the Vienna Convention. And so I think the connection and the importance of public international law has always been there, but it's now integrated into the WTO course as well. Things have changed a lot around the law school as far as trade is concerned, in the sense that we have much more specialized courses than maybe we had back in 1997. We have hosted multitudes of conferences here on WTO and on trade. We did a conference on trade and peace. We have done conferences on reforming the WTO. We have had visits by WTO staff and by lawyers here. We now have next week a conference with the Brazilian Trade Lawyers Group Association, I forget the actual acronym, but together with the Brazilian Embassy, and this is the third or the fourth year that we've been doing this. The students, since I arrived here, have started an International Trade and Investment Law Society, which has basically taken over and is the most active JD sort of law society, international law society. There used to be international law society, but I don't know they do that much. The International Trade and Investment Law Society works closely with the DC International Trade Committee. They work with the LLM board. We have always encouraged them to continue to do that. We have students now that work at USTR, at ITC, at Commerce. We have a first LLM student working at getting an internship at USTR. We have this Geneva program that I know that Ambassador Portales and Dean Claudia Grossman may speak about. This is a summer program that we have now in Geneva on international law and diplomacy, and this is an amazing opportunity for our students to actually be at the WTO. It's unique. And be taught by WTO. It's not only, by the way, limited to students. It's open to practicing lawyers, whoever. We have had graduate students and PhD students from South Korea, for example, that have joined us last year, and other countries now, and also diplomats. We actually have very good relationship with the WTO. The WTO office, both at the appellate level and the legal advisor's office, have had our students there. Some of our alums work there, of course. So we have developed a very good relationship there. And I think in town, and I just got recently a letter from the General Counsel of the USTR about how much he enjoys coming to our events on trade. We are also hosting for the third year in a row the WTO Moot Court Competition. That's the Moot Court Competition that is the European Law Students Association has set up in conjunction with the WTO. We hosted it. This is the third year we'll be hosting. The first year we hosted the North American. Last year we hosted all of the Americas, so we had participating from South America as well as North America, and we won the North American, actually, component 1 year, and so our students got to go to Geneva to do the finals. And this year it's going to be an All-American round two, and it's going to be co-sponsored by American Society of International Law. So there's a lot of stuff that's been going on in the trade area, a lot of it due to the students and entrance of both the JD and the LLM students. So that has all been wonderful for us. I want to just give a few sort of remarks about about how I see sort of the future. I don't have a crystal ball, but one thing that I think I and everybody here on this panel, I think that's why we share, is that we have never considered the LLM program to be just coming here to train lawyers and then have looking at it only from it from your technical perspective. Law is you guys. Future of international law is not some abstract concept out there. It's who are the players in it. You know, it's the people that makes the practice. Public international law, with all due respect, has been always the bailiwick of either European or North American practitioners traditionally. I always remember one ICJ judge lamenting to me about how he would not get to hear the country lawyers actually argue, that they would always start off doing a wonderful job, but then would turn the case over to one of their well-known either British or American practitioners who've done a lot of cases in front of ICJ. And he said, I wish that someday I would get somebody other than these four, you know, guys speaking to me. So it's very important, I think, for all of us to have voices from all over sort of enter into this area of not only pub but also international trade, where we see, for example, tomorrow our panel is going to concentrate on the role of smaller countries. Small trading countries, they don't show up in the dispute settlement as much. They don't show up in the textbooks that we teach. We only talk about the big trading partners. And I think that I think we all have a mission to have those who may not be in the center of having their voice heard in a discipline, to have the voice out there. And I think this LLM program, I'm so proud at you will see our alums talking about their role in the smaller developing countries and how they are actually making an impact in the area of international trade. It used to be, I'm going to stop with an anecdote, that when I was in school, and then when I left, I went to work for a law firm of Jones Day, and there was a managing partner of this law firm who told me, I said, why don't you hire, he wanted to have an international practice. I said, why don't you hire international lawyers, LLM lawyers? He said, I don't need LLM lawyers. I'll have my lawyers from Cleveland, this is in America, learn the language and go and practice there. Of course, the model just completely collapsed and it didn't succeed at all. But they still, when I would talk about my LLM students, when they saw you, they saw a country. They didn't see an individual. So if you happen to be from a country that wasn't a particularly lucrative business destination, it caused some problems as opposed to ones that were more in the investment area. I'm hoping and I think that our world and the way I see it is changing because of the internet, because of the social media. I think it's going to be, there's more commonality between us now. And I'm hoping that over time, what we share with each other is not going to be just the national boundaries of where we are, but actually our substantive interests, of areas of interest and the way that we, projects that we can work on and worlds, whether we are environmentalists or labor lawyers, what is it that makes us passionate? And I think that the internet, as I said, and the interconnectedness of all of us is making the conversation much, 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 much different than it used to be. We still are, of course, from different countries, and diversity is important, but the focus, I think, in the long term is going to be somewhat different because within countries we are so different from each other. So it would be, so that's something that I'm just watching and seeing amongst my, between the students, in that they share particular visions, like, as opposed to being primarily seen as nationals of a particular country. I'm sorry for being long-winded. That's it. Thank you very much.
Thank you. So good morning, everyone. It's a great pleasure to welcome you all back to the law school and to see you all again. It's really exciting to know that you feel such strong connections that you're willing to come from across the globe to spend this time with us. And I hope that over the next day or so, I get a chance to talk to all of you again. When David said I should talk about my reflections on how international law has changed over the time I've been speaking in the law school, teaching in the law school, and that I should do that in 5 minutes, I thought that's a really tall order, but I'll see what I can do with that. Let me start by saying I think one of the most exciting things to me about teaching in the International Legal Studies program is that because of the diversity of students and where all of you come from, that whatever's happening in the world somehow gets reflected in the law school. So that it doesn't matter whether it's something good or something bad, it all gets reflected back in the law school in some way. And we all can see how the events of the world affect us as human beings and also as us as lawyers. And as I was thinking back on my experience teaching international business and development law courses here, it struck me that that's been true as well here. When I started teaching at the law school, I started teaching international finance and investment courses. And when I started, which was in the late 1989, when I used to say in class that business lawyers need to learn something about environmental law and something about human rights law, because over the course of their careers, those issues are going to become critical aspects of business. I could always see in the students a lot of skepticism.
About the environment?
Even especially about the environment. but the skepticism particularly was, well, you don't understand what's happening in developing countries and the pressures that we face to have development and to create jobs, and this is all nice thinking. Today, the one of the most dramatic changes is that environment and social issues are seen as an integral part of business planning everywhere in the world. That isn't to say that we know how to do it well, because I think nobody knows how we do that well, but that the issue is a valid issue and that every responsible business lawyer should know enough about those issues to advise their clients is not something that's debated. In fact, this semester I'm teaching a course on called International Business Negotiations, which is a six-week simulation exercise, which I think some of you might have done when you were students. And when we started off, we were talking about environmental issues, and my co-teacher, who's a practicing lawyer, said to the students, this is not something you can avoid. This is just a necessary part of being a good business lawyer, is to understand what environmental issues are and how they impact on the transactions that you're working on. And I would say that's one of the most dramatic changes in business law over the last 20 or 30 years, is the sense that business, society and environment are all so closely connected that you have to think through how do we integrate them into one transaction. And at international law level, that's led to all sorts of codes of conduct, all sorts of new international bodies where cases can be brought, where issues can be raised. None of that is hard in the sense of enforceable law, but it's got importance because it has reputational risks and financial risks for companies. So I would say that's point number one, that where the world has come into the class, and now when I raise those issues, nobody questions it. As another issue which has changed, as Paddy was talking, struck me, is when I started teaching, it was the beginning of the Washington Consensus, and privatization was the order of the day. And when I used to teach nationalization, and I used every semester, I used to think to myself, should I be teaching students about nationalization now everything's being privatized? And I thought to myself, you know, the world always changes. And I used to say to the students, I'm teaching you about nationalization, not because it's relevant now, but I'm willing to take you a bet that during the course of your careers, nationalization will come back and it'll be important that you know and understand the law dealing with that. Well, today, certainly in my country, in South Africa, nationalization is a critically important issue, high on the political agenda, and we're not the only country. You can look around most of the countries in the world where resource nationalism is an important issue that's coming back. So that's trend number one that I would point to, where the world's come into the classroom. Trend number two is that as globalization has intensified, the demand around the world for global standards and global regulation has also grown. You can see that in finance in particular, which is probably the most advanced, where there are all these new capital adequacy standards, all standards for securities markets. You can see it with food safety. You can see it with all sorts of areas of conduct, where there's a demand for regulation at the international level that sets standards that everybody can follow. But we don't really have well-developed mechanisms for developing those standards. So that as a legal matter, they get developed also as soft law. They're not enforceable. They're there. They have, because they're seen as best practice, they have importance, but they're not necessarily enforceable in any way. But students need to understand these issues because they're going to have impacts on the way their clients and depending on who they work for, the companies and governments that they work for have to deal with issues. And so getting students to understand that international law means more than just what are the traditional sources of law, that it means all sorts of less traditional soft law sources is an important issue as well. The third issue that I think has come into the classroom, and Paddy Day alluded to this, and I think all of us know this, is the breakdown in global governance. The weakening of international organizations, the confusion and lack of coherence in global forums about how to make rules for the globe, all of that is becoming much more important. All of that, of course, is a reflection of the shifts in global power that are going on. We know that they're going on. We know that the Western powers are not as powerful relative to the rest of the world as they used to be now. We know they're rising powers now, like China, the BRICS. We can go on who all those powers are. We don't actually know how this is going to play out. And as I keep telling people, when you read about the decline of the Roman Empire and the Ottoman Empire, it took hundreds of years for empires to collapse, and it didn't happen in one straight line. Things go up and things go down, and we don't know how this process of change will take place. And it's certainly not inconceivable that the West will rise again. It's certainly not something that it would look like a safe bet at this point, but who knows? And that's something that influences the way global governance is going to play out, and it's something that our students have to think about. So when I put all this together, it seems to me a couple of conclusions you can draw about international development law, which are relevant, I think, to all areas of international law. One is, in a sense, is an increased demand for international law and an increased need for international law. But in fact, if you look at international law, at least in terms of the traditional sources of law, as spelled out in Article 38 of the ICJ statutes, there isn't very much international law that's actually relevant to the issues that I'm talking about. If you say, I want to be a good law-abiding, international law-abiding citizen in the way I do business or the way I make policy in my government, if you go look at international law, if you're lucky, you get general principles that tell you something about how you should behave. So if you want to know how should I behave in terms of human rights, the best you can do is look at the Universal Declaration on Human Rights and say, most of the companies I represent are not signatories to the Human Rights Convention, so they're not directly applicable. If I look at the Universal Declaration, it gives me very general principles, but it doesn't tell me how exactly I should apply that in this particular project. When I'm building this mine, what am I supposed to do with this community that's going to be moved because of the mine? Or because of the environmental damage, they're going to not be able to have access to the same crops that they used to. That the only places you can look are essentially soft law places, which are very imperfect. And in some ways, and I always gulp when I say this because it's definitely not very perfect, is the leading and the best sources of information is the World Bank and the International Finance Corporation and the Equator Principles. And none of those are particularly perfect. They're imperfect and they're constantly changing, but they're the best expression of experience of how you actually do this. And so that means we have to teach students this law, which is very imperfect, very uncertain, and constantly evolving. But what I also think we have to teach students is that that's a challenge, but it's also an opportunity. Because it means that the students, of the lawyers of the future, are actually have the opportunity to shape the law of the future as well. And that that's their responsibility and their opportunity, and that they can make their careers work, making the world a better place, working out how to make this law actually function in a responsible way. So let me end by saying, in a sense, what I think we need to do, and this is true for us as practice, as lawyers, as well as for our students, is we have to teach students to understand what the challenges that we face are, that how big the challenges are, and in a sense, how urgent they are. I mean, we all know with climate change that these challenges are not something that's far distant in the future. It's something that's affecting us now and needs to be dealt with now. I mean, I come from a country, and I'm sure many of you do too, which is a water-stressed country. So issues of climate and of environment are having a direct impact. I mean, I read the papers from South Africa now. There's talk about how in Johannesburg the water supply is being poisoned by acid from the mining industry. There's not enough water. How do we get water? I mean, these issues are things business people have to think about as well. So I think that's the first thing, is to understand the challenges. The second thing is we have to teach our students how to think critically and to think in a multidisciplinary way. Because the thing with this soft law is you can't become a good lawyer if you only think in narrow legal terms. You have to understand how it plays out in an economic and in a social setting as well. So I think that's the second thing. And then the final thing I think we have to do is we have to teach students about their responsibilities as lawyers. That it's not good enough to just say, I'm going to serve a client's interest to make money. You're not doing your job for your client unless you help them understand the risks of what they're actually facing, number one. And number two, that to think about their responsibilities to have what's sometimes called a social license to do business. Because if they don't have that sense of legitimacy, the risks and the cost to them are going to be extremely high. And what I always tell students as part of that also is, you're not just a lawyer. You're also a citizen of your country and a human being functioning in a world, and you have responsibilities in that sense that you have to bring into your legal practice as well. So I think all of this makes this an exciting time for legal practitioners, legal academics, and I think for our students as well. There's lots of challenge, but lots of opportunity.
Thank you.
Couple of things in the area of human rights. First of all, historic developments and why is this relevant for everyone, and it's not just an isolated area of the law. Up until the Second World War, the way in which a government treated or mistreated its own inhabitants was a domestic matter. And constitutional law, if there was a constitution or a customary law, depending on the country, was the outer limit of human rights protection. But different reasons questioned that model. The first was the Second World War, that dramatically presented to the world the issue of interdependence and the results of the paradigm of absolute national sovereignty. If you look at the Second World War, you see, for example, the killing of 300,000 Germans because they had the issues of inability or mental or physical issues, and they were not considered as belonging to a perfect race, or the destruction of a million gypsies, or the 6 million Jews, or the millions of individuals of other nations. With that resulted in the conclusion that the mistreatment by individuals, by their own governments, was a matter of global concern. We could not continue to say, well, you kill your own people, that's your problem. Conclusion took place also in a framework of growing interdependence. One expression of that is a trade, the environment, the development of weapons of mass destruction, the growing impact that the violation of human rights creates on other countries. To put it in a simple way, if in a country there are no labor laws, there is generalized repression, perhaps on the short run the products produced by that country will be cheaper in the international scene. Or generalized repression could result in waves of immigrants that create burdens for the neighboring country. All this happening in a context where there is hardly an issue that can be solved by a country alone. Whether we talk environment, peace and security, investments, everything is interconnected and growingly interconnected. So the conclusion came out, we need to regulate the way in which inhabitants are treated by their own citizens. Now, that was not an easy thing, because of the power of sovereignty. It's not the question of parliament saying this is what we're going to do and happen more or less automatically. Happened in a very, unregulated way, but really applying the conditions of life of the 20th and the 21st century, in the sense that it was unavoidable. And how it happened? First of all, we adopted the norms, a standard of achievement, a moral obligation. There were reasons for that, even after the atrocities of the Second World War. In the Soviet Union, we had Stalin, and he would not have accepted the binding norms to create human rights obligation. In the United States, we had racial discrimination de jure. Also, the application, I mean, there would not have been any chance of approval of a treaty if the Universal Declaration would have been a treaty. So, first we had then standard of achievement, moral obligation. But something wonderful happened with these declarations. Due to the conditions of life, the growing interconnectedness and so forth, they became binding through a process of customary law or treaty adoption. So we adopted the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, the Social, Economic, Cultural Rights, and I don't know how many treaties regulating situations of individuals, slavery, labor, women's rights, the rights of the child. So we really created an impressive structures of rights at the international level. And there is something wonderful on this, because up again until the Second World War, the most important actors and only actors in the international scenes were states. If you look at the Universal Declarations and the treaties, all of them say every human being, every human, every human. So we're not any longer, just citizens of a country that have a religion and ethnicity, sexual orientation, but we are all human beings. And that was an invention in international law. A very important thing. And every provision of this human rights treaty starts saying everyone, everyone, everyone. Very, very, very important normative achievement. That was, however, not enough to achieve the human rights protections of individuals, because we needed to alter dramatically the way in which we supervise compliance with the international obligation. In the past, if there was a violation of international obligation, basically, you needed, the state whose rights have been violated had a series of options at its disposal. In old international law, war was one option, was a way to achieve the compliance with the obligations of others. For me, it's like all the primitive law of the retaliation as to get satisfaction. Somebody violates me, I react. We all know what are the problems with that. If you are powerful, you have more chances to claim violation. Who adjudicates whether there is a violation or not? Now, we had the International Court of Justice, but this the jurisdiction is optional of the International Court of Justice. And then we developed in international law the idea also that states could claim that there was a violation of rights due to them, even if their own citizens were not the victims. I mean, violations, erga omnes, and so forth. But governments act on the basis of considerations such as economic, strategic, political, and so forth. Sometimes those include humanitarian considerations, particularly assessing what are the chances of a change in a certain area and how their interests will be served. But that was not enough, and it's not enough to ensure compliance of human rights, and we needed to invent and develop a new system of supervision. And what was that system of supervision? Commissions and courts that a la judiciary, you know, as we have invented and developed internally, a regional universal, and very importantly, where alleged victims can go directly suing, as if it were, their own state, even if necessary. This is a tremendous development in the area of human rights, that individuals can go against their own government, or whatever government, because if you are a victim, you don't think in terms of, well, in a different way, of strategic consideration, the political impact. You want redress. Well, so that's the process where we are now. I mean, the process of judicialization or the development of techniques of human rights, and that has advanced in different regions depending also of conditions and traditions and so forth. In Europe, we have the European system of protection. We have regional system. In the Americas, the Inter-American system of protection of human rights. We are organizing a huge conference on Monday, co-sponsored by over 50 important universities and centers from the hemisphere and abroad on the future of that system. And then we have, at the level of the United Nations, also ten treaty bodies that composed by independent experts that act, have powers of semi-judicial and judicial powers depending on the treaty. At the same time, we develop organs of collective political supervision. In the past, you had states expressing opinion. Now we have, for example, Human Rights Council. And again, the members of the Human Rights Council are government representatives. They act under, with political instruction. But there are techniques of parliamentary diplomacy. The debates are open, so you can say, well, yesterday you say that, today you say something different, so you can embarrass country, and record keeping for the same purpose. Also, we limit the absolute character of political discretionality, but providing the Human Rights Council reports by treaty bodies or experts that somehow limit the discussion or as to what's possible. Now, there is a lot in this area of human rights, a lot for individual lawyers. When I was the chair of the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, I report to a General Assembly of the Organization of American States that we had had 8 cases decided in 1995, because we were transitioning from a hemisphere with dictatorship and authoritarian governments to a hemisphere with elected governments. And against dictatorship, what we used mostly were country reports. You know, when you have thousands of disappearances, you would issue a report criticizing this. You cannot handle that with individual cases. But when you had elected government, there were more conditions to start deciding cases. Well, in 2001, when again I reported to the General Assembly, we had almost 100 decisions, some 90 cases of friendly settlement. And now there are over 1,500 petitions per year. They do not consider only, as because the conditions have changed, the traditional violation of human rights like disappearances or the torture and so forth and so on, but you see increasingly issues involving the protection of the right to property, freedom of expression, matters involving the independence of the judiciary, and so forth and so on. So we see an increased broadening of the field, with tremendous participation, I mean, by lawyers and judges and so forth and so on. We can say the level of judicial sophistication, as shown by the decisions and the reasoning and the case of character and the cases presented, has grown exponentially. We are in this process The Italians have an expression that says chiaro scuro, clear and dark, because we see on the one side this development, at the same time we all thought that we wouldn't see genocide again. And we saw a genocide in the former Yugoslavia, we saw genocide in Africa, we see the current situation in Syria, the lack of solution of open wounds of the international community, look at the situation in Israel, Palestine, and all this type of thing. And then we have not come yet to a full circle. Not that we always achieve it, but there are many shortcomings. But we don't have other option that to continue to try and develop a world where individuals can develop themselves to a limit of their potential and where all of us count. It depends on all of us, including all of you sitting here, and we can. That is the task before all of us. The law school offers more courses and seminars in international law than you can think of. Areas of specialization, centers and institutes, and with your support we will continue to do so. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I get to step out of my moderator role for a moment and speak a little bit about international and environmental law in my field. And I want to say first that the field of international environmental law has grown up in some ways with the specialization of international environmental law here at the law school. It's a relatively new field. Most of us claim that modern international environmental law started in 1972 at the Stockholm Conference. And others would say that it started in 1982 at the, or 1992 at the Earth Summit. In Rio 20 years ago. And in fact, it was at the Earth Summit in Rio where the law school announced the specialization in international environmental law. So not only is this the 30th anniversary of ILSP, it's also the 20th anniversary of the international environmental law specialization. And we just celebrated in our field the 20th anniversary of the Earth Summit and the broad global dialogue on environment and development. And as I look back on the field and where we are today and the growth in ILSP as well in this area, I have sort of mixed feelings. It's interesting to me to hear my colleagues speak and integrate environment into the discussion. So we hear that the trade field is talking very much about the environment, and Professor Bradlow is speaking about development and finance and how environment is shaping the way businesses do business. And I think that's all very true, and it may be one of the great successes of the field. But when you're in international environmental law, you feel really jealous of the other areas. You feel inferior, and it's not just me. It's the field. I mean, we don't have a robust organization like the WTO, and all of our trade and environment disputes get decided at the WTO. We don't have a similar institutional framework that's robust in global governance. Our United Nations Environment Program is essentially a scientific body that does research and does some convening, but has very little, no decision-making authority. If we look at the role of the World Bank and the IFC in finance and development, and of course the importance that finance and development are placed on, and economic matters are placed on at the national level, we recognize that the development in this area, environment, is increasingly being integrated, but it still feels like it's the kind of brought along as the kid brother, the younger sibling or something. And we certainly don't have the robust authority that the World Bank has in these areas, even as we try to attach environment onto these different things. And in the human rights field, we would die for, well, so many have died for, the right for individuals to bring petitions to an international commission or court. And we don't have that set of courts and commissions, and we don't have the broad principles that we find in human rights. What do we do have in the environment? We have a couple of things that are strong and strengthen our field. We have an amazing body of treaties that have been negotiated over the last 20 to 30 years. We have about a dozen treaties that have nearly universal participation by countries.
meaning 160, 170, 180, 190, 200 countries. The Montreal Protocol has every country in the world, at least it did have countries come and go, but as of about 6 months ago, every country in the world had ratified it. So we have broad participation for the concept of environment and broad participation in our treaties. The other thing we have that people commented on is we have a global environmental movement that didn't exist 20 years ago that can integrate environment into the social context of different countries and can bring international environmental issues into into the fabric of the economy and other things in ways that couldn't happen 20 years ago. And that's had a very big impact on the law. So if we look at the field today, for those of us in it, when we look at the treaties, what we would consider to be the great success of the field, they are quite impressive, but they're also somewhat narrow and ad hoc. The governance system has different secretariats spread around the world. There's no unifying coherence to the governance system. And the enforcement mechanisms and sometimes the norms are not very clear. We speak about our time in the 1990s as the happy drafters. We were the happy drafters of international environmental law. We run around the world drafting new treaties and new norms. But the difficulty of implementation and of percolating this down into the national level remains a big challenge. We don't have very many cases or conflicts that come up in the traditional public international law sphere, probably because when two countries have an environmental dispute, for the most part, it's in the web and fabric of many other relationships between the two countries, and the environmental conflicts don't rise to such a level, usually, that they want to bring the issue to the international court. It's not the same as territorial disputes, or in particular, or other more economic disputes that may bring the cases up to the forefront. That's changing a little bit as environment gets perceived more related to natural resources and the interconnections with water and natural resources become clearer. But we don't have that broad body of law being developed through courts or commissions. What we do have as well in the field is a number of global principles. They're not set out. One of our laments is we don't have a universal declaration, and the U.S. government and others always tell me whenever we push for it that you don't really want to try to negotiate global environmental principles because they'll be too weak. So we've avoided trying to do it as a formal governmental process to negotiate international legal principles. But we do see them percolating in soft law, as Professor Bradlow was mentioning, and starting to really have an influence at the national level. If you take principles like the precautionary principle or the polluter pays principle, which I won't bore you with what they mean, but you now see them in constitutions and domestic law, and the evolution of these principles not necessarily being adopted because they're international law or mandated by public international law, but because they make sense from a global environmental perspective. And you see these principles showing up in domestic law and being in some ways harmonizing domestic law and creating a kind of global environmental law that is unified in its global principles, but not really implementing or deriving from those formal sources of treaties or custom, as Professor Bradlow mentioned. And the other thing that you see these principles doing is exactly what Professor Bradlow was mentioning, which is the norms that are being attached to the private sector through different areas or different processes. And this means that we see a tremendous number of certification systems, labels. He mentioned the Equator Principles, which are the commercial banks' commitments, the largest commercial banks in the world's commitments to environmental and social standards for project finance. We have forest stewardship certification that significantly has affected the timber industry around the world, where for companies that are starting to demand, because consumers are demanding around the world, that logs and logging and timber be certified as environmentally sustainable. And in virtually every sector, whether it would be gold and diamonds and the effort to make Tiffany come out in favor of peace diamonds and clean gold, and every sector you can imagine, there's a global dialogue going on about what the right environmental standards should be. Again, not traditional international law, but very much percolating and penetrating the global economy. And that really demonstrates the sort of growing complexity over the last 20 years of international environmental law. It's no longer just looking at the treaties or the Rio Declaration, but understanding these processes of how international law is embedded in a global social context that includes a global environmental movement and global multinational corporations. Later in this conference, there'll be a panel on international environmental law trends, and Paul Hagen will be speaking. He's at one of the leading environmental firms in Washington, and as he'll tell you there, most of his practice today is dealing with not with complying with treaties, but with complying with product requirements, helping their clients meet the different supply chain requirements that are being placed on them for environmental considerations. So many of his clients want to sell in the global marketplace. Let's say they want to sell timber. It has to meet the timber certification requirements. They want to sell electronics. They have to meet some of these requirements that the retailers are putting on, or that manufacturers within the supply chain are putting on. So the complexity of the system and the focus on traditional international law, as others have mentioned, is changing, but we're still struggling for the accountability mechanisms as we leave this more traditional role. How do we enforce these mechanisms? How do individuals enforce these mechanisms? How do we participate in it? And that's going to be a big part of the challenge in the future, is how do we ensure that as we use these new different forms of law or norms, that they're attached with some measure of accountability and enforcement. And that really goes to the heart of lawyering and what we do as lawyers, whether it's enforced through supply chain contracts, through domestic legislation, or my personal favorite, through Greenpeace hitting the streets. Just kidding. But I think the takeaway from all of us in many ways is that these areas have become more complex, and I think international law is now so much more embedded in an international society than it was 20 or 30 years. If we think about the ability of this program to grow and to continue to attract students, the amazing change in social networking and social media, we really have an international society, which may be the precursor for new forms of international law that are different than what they were in the past, where international society was really just the collection of states. Not that that doesn't still remain important, but how do we shape this international law in an era of a new global society? That's really the question. Thank you. Yeah, let's see if there are any questions on any topic or subject. Comments, questions? Yeah. Introduce yourself, yeah, please, yeah.
From where? No, but the country.
Because from my point of view, I haven't heard about these things, so that those bring them over the mature.
Well, indeed, there is a vibrant discussion in the hemisphere about the Inter-American system. We're having a conference here on Monday, and I invite you to come if you haven't already registered. I think it's worthwhile coming. We have the President of the Inter-American Commission, the Executive Secretary, former Executive Secretary, academics, and the Secretary of the Court. So I think it's interesting to come. Now, issues there. There is a group of countries I believe see the Inter-American System of Protection of Human Rights as incompatible to a certain extent to their own national goals. For example, the Inter-American System of Protection of Human Rights established rights like due process, freedom of expression, everyone equal before the law, and so forth and so on. And to give an expression, an example, the current government of Venezuela, who withdrew from the American convention, cannot withdraw from the American Declaration without leaving the OIS, has a different vision on the independence of the judiciary. The current president of the Supreme Court of Venezuela said, "We do not agree that the judiciary should be independent." There is a model of transformation based on the centralization of power. You see, over 80% of the judges are provisional. I'm describing a situation that can take different forms. Well, the human rights tradition thinks that an independent judiciary to adjudicate on alleged arbitrary actions by the executive or to solve disputes among citizens is essential for the purposes of a free society. If you take the view that the judiciary should be subservient to your national goals, that's incompatible with the American system. The reason also why Venezuela allegedly withdrew from the system is a decision that Venezuela said this is in favor of terrorists because they say you cannot torture people. I'm the chair of the Committee Against Torture. Many countries come to us and say, you protect terrorists come to you. Yeah, the convention doesn't say that you can't torture terrorists. You cannot torture anyone, whether it's true or not, we will assess. But you see, so the system had, I think that for a country like Venezuela, the system and the tradition of human rights, they have a different view of the situation. And if they would be here, they will articulate something. So they don't want an independent supervision based on this set of values. Second thing, you see countries like your own, Ecuador, on freedom of expression, a decision by a court's decision against a journalist, $60 million penalty and jail for alleged libel, injury, so forth, against the president. Imagine that would be true. First of all, when we were in the commission, Inter-American Commission, already we established that contempt laws, in other words, criminalizing false allegations, injury, whatever you want, against the political organs, was incompatible with the convention. Why? Because we want vibrant discussions. The authorities are entitled to their honor, and they could defend themselves through civil liability that is proportional. Yeah, that is proportional to the damage. But you cannot start $60 million penalty and jail. I mean, the most important duty of many former presidents on this region is to stay out of jail on accusation of corruption. So I've tried to convince some of them saying, listen, accept that there is no contempt law. You'll have a better chance not to be accused again for corruption afterward because you'll try to behave before. And again, in the region, there has been a movement. Only 9 countries now have contempt law, and many only in the books. And then Ecuador was furious about this decision of the Inter-American system. I think Ecuador is wrong on that matter. I mean, and again, if the journalist was saying things that intentionally, in the opinion of the president, require a defense of his honor, a proportional... now, again, the president pardons, but the record remains, and the pardon means, I mean, if the journalist reopens anything, it goes to jail again. So the main issue of the system is the lack of resources. And again, if you adhere to these values of independent judiciary, freedom of expression, everyone counts before the law. Now, the system is not only under strain by those countries. There are other countries, that Colombia among others, that resent the fact that they were mentioned in a chapter of the annual report that claims that there are violations of human rights. There are issues of compliance with of the political organs, of the collective supervision that they need to give a guarantee of compliance. So there are a series of issues, and we're going to discuss all those things on Monday, and I think it's going to be, if you are interested, it's great if you can. So.
One last question. Professor Eli may need to sneak off for class, but go ahead and ask the question from there.
Hi, I'm Max Trujillo. I'm an alumnus. Good morning.
Good morning.
And I want to ask you, following up on the risk and the threats that the Inter-American Commission and the system itself may be facing or challenges.
I'm sorry, but they are interested in
this. No, let's go.
I wanted to ask, in terms of the OAS itself, there are some rumblings throughout the region about whether or not it is still relevant to the region and whether or not there should be a new organization being created. What can be done, or what is the future for our Inter-American system based on the OAS, and how can that be strengthened?
The OIS is the organization existing in the region that provides a domain, a space, and a political space for interaction with the United States, Canada, and other countries that are obviously not Latin American. So, is it necessary to have a collective political a forum, institutions where there is a dialogue and an ability to influence and bring issues between the Latin America and the United States and Canada. I think that some of us feel that that's necessary. The OAS certainly has changed its role, and in some ways positively. In the past, the Organization of American States, I mean, when it was created, it was a department of the State Department, and it was called in Latin America a Ministry of Colonies for Latin America. That's not the current situation of the Organization of American States. It's a forum where it's possible to find the coordination of policies and have the, as I mentioned before. Second thing, that is valuable to explore areas of where it's possible, not just to discuss things, but where there are matters that could be agreed that allow for further development, that includes environment, trade, and so forth and so on. There are other international organizations that could be created, and they are created and could go further for the Latin Americans or South Americans or Caribbean. But some of us have a sense of loss and loss of opportunity in terms of the development of the organization, of this organization, which allow create a space and domain to the achievement of certain goals and the coordination of action. Now, in terms of the Inter-American system, perhaps the most important thing, or one of the most important things done by the OIS, is the Inter-American System of Protection of Human Rights. There are different developments in the Inter-American system. You have countries that have ratified the American Convention, some countries that have not ratified the American Convention. Would have been great to have everyone ratifying it. But still, if they haven't, they are subject to the American Declaration. The United States, one of the few instances where individuals can go and complain is the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights under the American Declaration. So the issues involving the application of death penalty, the lack of consultation with embassies involving the detention of foreign individuals, all these type of things can be presented there. The U.S. considered that the decision of the Commission under the Declaration as a recommendation, but in the aggregate, we have seen modification of behavior. So there is also a sense of loss if that would be not any longer possible. So we have here a program on international organizations, law and diplomacy. The director is Carlos Portales, who was ambassador to the Organization of American States. And perhaps I think it would be great, you know, if you have time to get his vision also. He has studied the system a lot.
Thank you, Grossman. Thank you for the questions. I also just want to add that in the environmental area, there's a lot of discussion of the need to strengthen the regional mechanisms as a part of the governance system, and the OAS remains very relevant for that. And one of our speakers later this afternoon is the lawyer for the sustainable development part of the OAS and is an alum. So we're going to take a break right now for 10 minutes. We'll start. We're a little bit behind, but that's okay. We'll catch up. We'll start back here at 10:45 and have a discussion on the lighthearted topic of torture.
And we have champagne outside.
We have champagne. So enjoy yourself. Thank you all.